cuteness. It's kind of like honey. And when you like take honey with your cough medicine, it tastes a lot better.
How can cuteness be used to sugarcoat difficult messages?
Cuteness is very powerful, and then that power can be used. It can be used in malice.
And cute characters can say or do the sort of things that would otherwise be unacceptable.
Early animation, it starts off as this very crass mockery of Black people. So a lot of the characters appear lazy and all they do is dance.
But it can also be used to deal with hard truths. In the last episode, we delved into the alchemical powers of cute in pop music. In this episode, we join another artist commissioned for the Somerset House exhibition, Cute, Brooklyn-based Sean Keir Lyons, looking at how cute characters can be used to say the things we might struggle to say directly.
How do you make something more palatable to understand, like white supremacy? I guess my way of doing it is like through humor.
In her practice, Sean Keir brings the grotesque and the cute together to tackle challenging themes. In this episode, Sean Keir explores how cuteness can be a double-edged sword. How can cute characters be used to deliver the sort of messages we normally turn away from? And how can the ambiguous nature of cute help to tell complex stories?
Cute is so complex. I can like hide behind cuteness, but I also can like address what I'm saying through cuteness as well. I love to like think of myself as a character. I guess like a good example of that is like the flower drawings that I made during the pandemic, where when I started it, I was like really messed up. So the world that I made was at war because I was at war with myself, you know? And the world is also, I think, you know, I'm a trans woman, like the world is at war with me a lot of the times. I did this by making these characters like hyper cute, but like holding weapons with a deranged face. But a lot of people, when they saw them, they weren't threatened by them at all. They were just like, oh, this is really cute. But like literally some of them have like maces and knives. It's not just like nice drawings and cute sculptures and stuff. It's like really working through some like deep, deep root work with myself and trying to figure out like a higher love for myself. And just like a person like me who like suffers from depression, cuteness kind of like helps my practice, like helps my mindset. I feel like cuteness has built a thicker skin for me. Ever since I was little, I liked like cartoons, and still to this day, like cartoons can like really direct change in my life. So for the cute exhibit, I decided to do a sculpture that I've been waiting years to make. It's a beast, but you know, it's based off of gargoyles.
It was a time of darkness. It was a world of fear. It was the age of gargoyles.
It's an animated series from the 90s. And I don't know, just really inspired by like the dynamics and just like flip cuteness on its way, where, you know, I make this like dragon type thing and she looks really kind, but she also like doesn't, you know, she has like talons and like, I don't know, she has armor. She's probably an avatar, like a part of me for sure. Not all of me though, no. In my work, I address ambiguous ideas on cuteness. And in this podcast, I want to address more of the darker sides of cuteness and how that shows up in animation from medieval times to now.
My name is Chima Dititso Gariba, born and raised in Accra, Ghana, West Africa. I work in animation and in illustration.
One person I want to do that with is Chima Gariba, creator of The Big Blue, a animated sitcom based on these children who quite literally take care of the planet.
What does cute mean to me? The power of being cute is that nobody sees it coming. It's kind of like a way of being like, if you bit me, I'd forgive you. You know what I mean? Cute has his uses. Cute has his uses.
Yeah. I wanted to ask Jima how he uses the mechanism of cuteness to address something as tough as climate collapse.
In a broader sense, I wouldn't talk about anything if I didn't have a way to make it bearable. Because all I want to talk about are the scary things.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I'll make it look good so that we can talk about it. Because I promise you, if I make it look the way it's supposed to look, you're not going to want to fucking talk about it. Nobody wants to talk about Palestine. They'd much rather sit down and watch Lion King 2. And after the movie, maybe we can talk about how you felt about the hyenas being mistreated. But like, there's like things I want to talk to my nieces and nephews about like bad people, but like not in the obvious way that people are bad. You know what I'm saying? And the only way we're going to get to talking about it is something cute. That's the only way. It's only through some nursery rhyme or only through a Dr. Seuss book or only through, I don't know, that Pixar movie. Otherwise, babe, I'm going to need therapy after this conversation. You know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah.
It's a good way to get people to look at stuff that they don't want to look at.
You're right.
It's manipulative. Sorry.
I think people are allowed that. I think we should be allowed to like see it from the inside out. People don't know how to analyze themselves. We're not built to analyze ourselves. There's nothing telling us to analyze ourselves. And I think watching something cute play out, you can see yourself in it. So I think it's really important. Do you think cuteness is central in the history of animation? And how has it been used?
Part of it is being disarming, you know? The nature of caricature is that you understand that it's like a character, first and foremost, and that secondly, you're like willing to look at him, you know? Mm-hmm. Also, just like, you can like imbue something with life so it feels a little bit more detached from you. So like, even Bugs Bunny, Mickey Mouse, like, I don't think it's a coincidence that they're all animals, you know? They can have things happen to them and you can still understand that that's a character. But I think there's a different part of your brain where you're like, it's just an animal. Bugs Bunny is a lot less threatening because he's a rabbit with a gun. But if that was like another guy, I think you'd be like, that guy's like scary. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
but because
absolutely.
He's like naturally like, being hunted because he's cute. Mm-hmm. I think there's a reason that Mickey Mouse is not just like a white guy.
Do you think Mickey Mouse is a white guy?
No, I think Mickey Mouse is a mouse, but that's what I'm saying. I think because you can give an animal a freedom of cuteness that you can't give to a person.
Yeah.
It's useful. Like you can be a gun-wielding animal and I don't find you intimidating.
You can convey all sorts of ideas using animals and fantastic creatures that you cannot convey in other ways. My name is Janetta Rebold Benton. I am the Distinguished Professor of Art History at Pace University in New York.
Dr. Janetta Rebold is a world-renowned gargoyle expert. And after making the gargoyle for Somerset House, I wanted to talk to Dr. Janetta to get some more base knowledge on gargoyles and how those characters were used to tell difficult stories.
A gargoyle, officially, is a water spout, and they are a specialty of the Middle Ages. They're found in particular on Romanesque and Gothic churches and cathedrals. They're also found on private homes. And if they don't spew water, they are grotesques. I describe them as gargoyle wannabes, but gargoyles are most frequently monstrous creatures.
I mean, that's kind of why I made the sculpture in the first place, because I think of water as it being like the collective thought. Like when you die, obviously, like you go into the ground, but like part of your essence is like filtered into like the rainwater, into the rainwater, into the sea. We are part of water. The idea of a conduit kind of controlling water was really inspiring to me. Could we discuss what are like, are they formed as deities? Are they formed as demons? Are they like, what is their purpose?
There are many, many theories as to why these gargoyles were created, because a simple half cylinder would function just as well. There are three categories. There are some humans, not always behaving well. There are some real animals. Dogs and lions are the most frequently depicted among actual animals, but the majority of them are monstrous creatures, what I call composite creatures, compiled of parts of actual animals, but put together in ways that would be inconceivable to Mother Nature. And the meaning of something, I argue, hinges on context. But some of them, they're meant to protect you from evil to which you would be susceptible. That's one view. There is another view that the gargoyles are always watching, that they monitor who comes and goes to church. I've never found any two that are actually identical. And that is a medieval approach to things.
So basically, these characters were used to tell moral stories or point to moral ideas.
Yes, absolutely. It's didactic art. And part of the reason why it would be so popular, so important, is that the vast majority of people are illiterate.
It's like so interesting that you say that, because like I would say that like the early precursor to like learning in general now in our day and age is cartoons. Even now, like even things that like I find hard to grasp emotionally, some of the new child like TV shows, I'm like, have me in tears. I'm like, I did not, you know, think I needed to like do that much deep diving about myself. But like this small animal just like made me cry and made me realize some things about myself. Could gargoyles, could they have been thought to be like a precursor to cartoons and animation?
Oh, I think yes, definitely. But they're not. They were not targeting children at all. They were targeting the adults, those who could walk into church. But I think it's very much the same concept. You can convey all sorts of ideas using animals and fantastic creatures that you cannot convey in other ways. Because you can say things using an animal that you cannot say in terms of imagery, using an image of a human being. I think the most telling example, Hieronymus Bosch in the late Middle Ages, very early Renaissance, around 1500, the Garden of Delights, in the lower corner of this triptych, you have a depiction of a pig dressed as a mother superior. And this pig is forcing a dying man. He has a document over his leg. She is forcing him to sign it, and it would give all of his earthly goods over to the church. And this is clearly a criticism of this practice. He got away with it because he substituted a pig for a person.
After listening to Janetta talk about the grotesque creatures and their placement, even their placement on churches, it made me think about how racism is portrayed through animation. More specifically, how Black American people were portrayed through animation. I wanted to know more about Jima's take on how Blackness is portrayed in animation.
Let's take it to caricature, not necessarily just Blackness. In the history of like image making, which evolved into animation, so comic strips and everything like that, like there's a comic book called Mouse about the Holocaust. It's like an analogy that's like drawn between mice and rats, you know? And I think using symbols like that as a basis to have larger discussions has always been a thing. I think that trickles down all the way into animation in the sense that there's like Donald Duck, Bugs Bunny that were like initially used for war propaganda. You know, the caricatures just grow and grow and grow and change and evolve. And there are terrible caricatures of every race in animation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then while we're on the subject, this is going to segue into my next question. You know, we had the Proud Family growing up. We had like the PJs. We had like, you know, a lot of Black animation Bebe's Kids. I think the big presence of those movies that's like is the emphasis on Blackness. I like that in The Big Blue that these two children just happen to be Black and they happen to be saving the world and taking care of the planet.
Right.
Which is like really sick. Like, there's no, like, we're black. This is, we're going to do a black show. It's going to be a black thing. Black. Everyone, black. It's just, like, it happens to be two black children taking care of the world. Also, I would love to say that, like, I love that there are two black children at the forefront of, like, taking care of the planet.
Right.
Period. I'm from Brooklyn, so it's, like, that was really hard for me to understand growing up. Because everyone here is like, this place is dirty. We don't give a fuck. So with that, I would love you to tell us more about Big Blue. And how would you, if I had never seen it before, how would you describe it?
It's a sitcom on a submarine on a night where you have to babysit the youngest in your family. I was talking to my older sister about this the other day. I was like, I think I know what I'm supposed to do. And it was one of the things I felt like I was supposed to do. And the criteria for it were like underwater. And then there were other things that I was like, okay, there are things that I want to tell my nieces and nephew, but I don't have the vocabulary or the capacity outside of this way to do it. You know, like, sit down, let me tell you a story. They're not really interested in the stories I sit down and tell them. And I can't draw fast enough. This is the best shot I got to say anything. I'm talking to them, so they need to know I'm talking to them. So they look like me. My nieces and nephew could tell that they look like them. And they can look at it. You know what I mean? It's not traumatizing.
Mm-hmm. So I would love to talk about my favorite character so far. I mean, this is right now. BB, obviously. Is iconic. BB said, I'm not a baby. I'm actually the planet. Please don't fuck with me. Let me brush my teeth. Can I please brush my teeth? Can we talk more about BB and why the most powerful being in this story, or like the most powerful thing in the story, is so fucking cute?
Well, I thought that was just a funny idea. Like, there's like Captain Planet where they have Mother Nature. And I don't know, growing up, it felt like Mother Nature was like a mom. It's stronger than you. It's going to give you the things you need from it. And you can just like cultivate it and take the things you want from it or whatever. But like, what if Mother Nature is just like a strong baby?
Genius.
And like, you're supposed to take care of her. And maybe she'll protect you. You know what I mean? Like, maybe, but you're not taking care of them because you think that they'll protect you. You're taking care of them because you feel like you have to protect them. And then there were other things, people being like, are you sure it's going to be funny? Or like, are you sure it's not going to be too scary? So it was just a lot of running back home and doing images to be like, no, it's going to look like this. Is this too scary? And then negotiating it.
Okay. All right. I love that. And then when you said too scary, and I thought that was interesting because I was just like, I know that cuteness is a mechanism. I mean, it's how I deal with trauma. Like, how did you use cuteness as a conduit to deal with trauma? Because obviously, like, that's what these children shows are about, like, teaching children how to deal with trauma. Like, how do you use it as a conduit?
I don't know. Well, the trauma of the thing I was talking about hasn't, well, it started to happen, but it hasn't taken full effect. Like, it's about the environment, so. And I had to make a whole TV show about it, so I don't know if that means I'm dealing well with it or terribly.
I would, you know, I'm personally say well. I'm gonna say well. The thing that I use in my work that, like, I've used giving these things kind of, like, true human character to, like, really get off or, like, really say what's on my mind or just, like, address some things. Like, I made a whole series about flowers that, like, fight. And I kind of compared their identity to Black identity, which is still in the same, where it's, like, Black pop culture is, like, very... It's the dynamic of American culture in a lot of ways. But Black people are still kind of... They are still, like, third, second-rate citizens. And I think the same way of flowers in a lot of ways, like, where they are, like, second-rate citizens. When I decided to make... Well, we're calling her Benevolence... The gargoyle that I made, she is like fashioned over a couple of different animals. She's like reptilian, but she's also wolf-like, also something of the sea and something of flora. I would love to know what a medieval audience would have thought about benevolence.
I think they would love her. really, she would be dubbed a composite creature because she is compiled, as you just described it, from bits and pieces of animals of all types. And that was very much in accord with the medieval mentality, which does not prefer black or white. Instead, all the shades of gray in between in interpretations. The lion, king of the beast, even in antiquity, right through the Middle Ages, usually the lion is a good symbol. Noah's Ark, the first animals, the pair of animals onto and off of the ark are lions. They have, oh, this is a terrible pun, but they have pride of place. Sorry. So the lion is usually good, but the lion can also be evil. The lion can be something that menaces. Daniel in the lion's den. So God will intercede on behalf of those who have faith. So Daniel is menaced, but he is never attacked. A lion is fierce or friendly. You can interpret it like this or like that, and both are equally valid. In regard to composite creatures, can I just tell you my all-time favorite composite creature? And this is from the bestiary. The ant lion.
Oh.
That is a cross between an ant and a lion. And what bothered people was not the inconceivable conception of this creature, but instead the fact that one animal was a vegetarian and the other was a carnivore. That's what bothered them.
I would love to talk to you more about some of the body, like, marginalia in medieval art. Like, you know, for example, like the penis tree.
like, yes.
Where,
things that intend to offend. Okay. It is a general misconception that gargoyles always spew their water from their mouth, when in fact, there are a few examples where they use the other end of the digestive tract, and during a rainstorm, the defecating gargoyles are striking in appearance, and they are found on churches. People are always surprised when they come across these things. People expect it in medieval literature because they've all read Chaucer, but they don't expect it in medieval art, which is so dominantly in the service of the church. But wow, all sorts of things go on. I mentioned the defecating gargoyles. I knew about the one at Autun Cathedral, and I had gone there to photograph, and I could not find it. And I was so reluctant to go inside and explain to the priest what I was looking for. And I went around the building a few times. I finally found it, and it's sort of up in the shadows. It's on the right side. But I would personally say they may also have been made for the self-esteem and satisfaction of the medieval carver, the sculptor, and the novelty of the gargoyles may have been a way of exerting their own personality. Ergo, ego can be satisfied by carving one of these unusual composite creatures.
Mm, I mean, that's real. I mean, the one that I made is loosely based off of me, so I understand. I'm like, that's what I... I mean, I'd like to speak about transness without, like, directly being like, hi, I'm trans. So it's just like this idea of not just like when you're trans, it's like a transformation, changing the body, like going from whatever you were born as to something else. So in this one, I was like, what would I look like as a beast? Like, what would you, for benevolence, I was just like, I feel very kind. I feel very feminine. I want people to also know that, like, don't fuck with me. Like, as well, in the same regard, like, you know, have that ambiguity. So that's why she is like, don't play with me. She's like, please don't play with me. She's like, I am a reptile. Like, so are there cute gargoyles? And like, could we think of them as like cute medieval avatar, like medieval avatars?
Yes, because the devil could terrify, but the devil could also be droll. And there are many examples where I argue that these are cute. I don't know whether I used the word cute, but ones that sort of charm, ones that engage, ones that entice you. There are several of them that look, they're smiling. Some are actually laughing as if they get a joke. Maybe they're laughing at the people down below, but some of them really are hardly frightening. On the contrary, they could be termed cute.
What would you say is the modern equivalent of the gargoyle? What is our gargoyle today, or is it just the gargoyle? Like,
benevolence would be the modern equivalent of it. Your creature.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks to Sean Kier Lyons, Jima Gariba, and Dr. Janetta Rebold. You can check out Cute at Somerset House until the 14th of April. The Process is produced by Alana Chance and presented by me, Laurent John, for Somerset House. The exec producer is Eleanor Scott. The theme music is by Carr Beard, and the series is mixed by Mike Woolley. We're brewing up the next batch of episodes for The Process at the moment, due out later in the year. But in the meantime, make sure you subscribe so they jump straight into your podcast app. Thanks for listening.